Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Women's History, a channel of the New Books Network. I am Rebecca Turkington, and I am joined today by Dr. Jasmine Calver to discuss her new book, Anti-Fascism, Gender, and International Communism, the Comité Mondial des Femmes contre la Guerre et le Fascisme, 1934-1941, which has just been published by Routledge as part of its Studies in Fascism and the Far Right series. Jasmine, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
So I'm really delighted to be able to talk more about your book today, because the Comité Mondial des Femmes, or for our English listeners, that is the International Committee of Women Against War and Fascism. I think we'll probably refer to them as the CMF from here on out, as you do in your book. They are a really fascinating organization. They're loudly anti-fascist, much earlier than many other women's organizations. And as you explain so well in this book, they really bring a gender analysis to the problem of rising fascism in Italy, Germany, and Japan. You also argue they're one of the first popular front organizations in Europe that combines, you know, communist and socialist membership above party politics. And yet there's shockingly little about them in existing scholarship. So this work is a really helpful primer on who the CMF were, how they functioned, and their links to other interwar social and political movements. Throughout this book, you write both about sort of the organizational and the logistical program of the CMF, as well as how they framed that program for different audiences, and, you know, how they co-opted or how they challenged different narratives about womanhood. So we'll talk about both of those tracks today. But before we jump into the thematic things, how did you first come across the CMF? What drew you to this research?
So for my master's, which I did at the same institution as I did my PhD, which the book is based on the research from that, I was looking at the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom and why a Russian branch wasn't created in the early period after the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom was created in 1915. And I was looking for sort of alternative groups that Russian women joined to confront war and the associated ideologies around it. And initially, I started looking at the Amsterdam Pleyel movement, which is a precursor to the CMF. But it became clear that there was a specific women's organization that Russian women were more closely involved with, I would say, than Amsterdam Pleyel. And that was the CMF. And initially, my PhD research was going to be focused more on Amsterdam Pleyel, but then I came across some very helpfully digitized sources, and the rest is history. And I decided to focus on the CMF instead.
So tell me a little bit more about those sources. Because there hasn't been a lot written on this group, was it hard to track down information, or was it a question of these just sort of hiding in plain sight that people hadn't examined from this perspective?
Absolutely. So when I was doing my master's and I was kind of looking into this new organization that I'd come across, it was not particularly clear that I would be able to access any sources if any were available. It was a strike of fate, I think, that I happened to be on Twitter one day and somebody had posted a link to these sources that had been recently digitized as part of a partnership between the Université de Bourgogne and the Russian State Socio-Political Archives. Initially, I just thought it was something that could potentially be useful as sort of extra sources on the French Communist Party, but it turned out that there was a lovely big section on the CMF that I didn't know existed. So obviously their physical holding place is in Moscow, but the digitized project means that I have quite nice, easy access to it, and I could keep going backwards and back to it, and there were no sort of financial costs for me associated with that, which was very, very nice. And that's how I sort of pivoted towards the CMF away from Amsterdam Playel. So yes, I got very, very lucky that those sources existed and I could use them in conjunction with physical sources in France, for example.
The power of serendipity and social media, I guess.
Absolutely.
So let's start at sort of the 10,000 foot look at this organization. Could you give just a general summary of the CMF? How would you describe them? What were their goals?
So there is two words that I like to give people when I talk about the CMF to kind of impress how important they are. And one is that they were ambitious, and the other is that they were rather complex. And that's because I think they were guided by ideologies from a very broad spectrum. So there was the feminist gender aspect of it, the focus on emancipating women, specifically through things like the vote and women's right to work. Then there was socialism, which was a little bit more of a, it was clear that they were to the left of the political spectrum. But then there was the communism, which was meant to be covert, and you see in the book that quite often that wasn't the case, but it was meant to be sort of a secret that they were a communist group. So that plays into it, and there's a lot of conflict between the communist side of things and the bourgeois, in inverted commas, feminist side of things. Then there's the pacifist, anti-fascist side of things, and to what extent the women's pacifism was absolute when they're also militantly anti-fascist. There's that debate there, and specifically the impact of fascism on women and children. Then there's the internationalist side of things. They're very heavily focused on international campaigns. Women from almost every continent were a part of it. Activism crossing borders in a sort of transnational way, and also quite global campaigns. But they also focus a lot in the national sections on different national issues facing women. And it was also quite humanitarian and philanthropist in terms of organizing campaigns to alleviate the issues created by war and fascism on women and children, most specifically. And all of these things create this very ambitious, very complex organization that leads to some intense conflicts internally and with other women's groups of this period, but also to some really effective humanitarian organization. And to kind of to confront the idea of their goals. So the major one was to inform people, specifically women in this case, about the threat of fascism in Europe for both women in places like Germany and Italy, but also the threat of that spread more broadly across Europe. There was the promotion of Popular Front ideals before it became adopted by the Comintern. So the idea was not only to popularize it among kind of the general population, but also among communist leaders. To defend the Soviet Union was a huge one that, again, they tried to keep covert, but were not entirely successful at that. And also, again, to construct those effective humanitarian campaigns to alleviate issues faced by women in times of fascism and war.
Well, complexity is definitely a good concept in the case of the CMF. Can you talk a little bit about where they fit in the broader political context and sort of the timeline of anti-fascism? You talked about your work on Amsterdam Playel movement. Who else was organizing against fascism in this period, and what was their relationship to the CMF?
For the most part, anti-fascist organization in this period wasn't done by specifically anti-fascist groups. A lot of them were either political groups, so communism would be one example of it, the most glaring example of it. But even then, it wasn't necessarily directly focused on fascism. It could be focused on social fascism, which is essentially just socialism, to boil it down to a very brief explanation. And the issue that you have with kind of the broader anti-war groups is that they tended to want to appear politically neutral because they felt that was more beneficial for their work, especially women's ones. And so that meant that anti-fascist campaigns were seen as the antithesis to that, despite it being a concern for groups like Wilf, who did try and hold a women's anti-fascist congress from, I think it was around November 1933. It didn't end up working out because they were worried about the implications that this would have on their political neutrality. Amsterdam Pleyel was built from 1932 onwards, and it was a group that was a little bit split in terms of their goals. It was the creation, Amsterdam Pleyel was the creation of two congresses. So it was the Amsterdam Congress Against Imperialist War, so a focus that specifically doesn't target fascism, and the Pleyel European Workers' Congress, which was more anti-fascist than the previous one. It was the more popular group in general between it and the CMF. It was meant to be mixed gender, although in practice that wasn't necessarily the case. Women were heavily underrepresented, but it had more prominent figures in it. So it was led by two prominent French novelists, Henri Barbusse and Romain Rolland. And it said that it had the support of some really major figures in the world in that time, including people like Albert Einstein. So it was much more popular than the CMF, which tended to link mainly already politicized women or women already involved in activism. So the CMF in and of itself was kind of a unique organization in this period in that it was directly geared towards women and anti-fascist by name and nature, whereas other ones had just focused more on kind of the broad impact of war, for example. Mm-hmm.
So speaking of the politicized women who got involved with the CMF, your first chapter is really about these four women who essentially ran the organization. Could you talk a little bit more about those four that you outline? What are their political backgrounds? And then how did each of them first encounter this group?
Absolutely. So the nice thing about all of the leadership in the CMF is they all come from vastly different backgrounds within sort of the same westernized society. So three of them were French and one was British, and I'll come to her last. So Bernadette Cataneo, who I broadly identify as kind of the main leader of the group, if you like, she was the general secretary of the CMF, but she did most of the organizing work. She grew up in the Côte du Nord. She had a very poor background and was only actually educated officially till the age of 12. But this was a place where she was introduced to socialist ideas very early. Her teacher, she cited as being one of the great influences on her political upbringing. But she eventually moved to Paris and started work, and she got involved in quite low-level strike organization here. And during one of her jobs, she met her husband, Jean-Baptiste, who she became close collaborators with, and joined the Communist Party from there. And she essentially became involved with the CMF because of her work with the communist trade unions, with the Confédération Générale du Travail Unitaire. She became what they described as the responsable femme of the Communist Party in this period, and she was sort of naturally chosen by the Comintern leadership as someone who would be an effective leader. Then we'll talk a little bit more about another communist woman who was heavily involved. So that was Marie Rabatté. She was the leader of the French section of the CMF in particular, but she did work with the international group too. And she was introduced to politics because of the Dreyfus affair. She was, her father was very politically engaged, and he very vocally condemned Dreyfus's accusers. And she was also really heavily influenced by her teachers as well at primary school. And she joined the PCF by 1921, very early on in its history, and also met her husband through communist politics. Octave Rabatier was a CGTU, again, organizer. He was very important as a propagandist and worked for the Comintern quite closely. They lived for a time in Moscow. They worked in Spain in the early years preceding the Civil War. She was very important for the Comintern. And again, she was highlighted by Comintern leaders as somebody that would be very useful to have as part of the CMF. So they were both kind of introduced to the CMF at the very beginning. They were involved with its very early genesis. So one French woman who was really not that closely involved with communist politics at the beginning was Gabrielle Duchesne. She never joined the Communist Party, but she is what we would describe as a fellow traveller. She essentially supported communism without being a Communist Party member. And this was essentially because of her bourgeois upbringing and her role in, again, in inverted commas, bourgeois women organisations. So she too was introduced to politics through the Dreyfus affair. Her and her husband were considered Dreyfusards. She was a little bit older than most of the other organisers. And so she was introduced to activism through this, and from the Dreyfus affair went into organising in terms of lower class women's organisations, specifically for women involved in the garment trade. And she joined the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom from its inception in 1915 and became president of French Wealth, which she led until her death in the 1950s. So it was a very long time that she was involved. And obviously, because of that, she could not join the Communist Party, because it would affect, again, that political neutrality that these groups tried to strive for. She was a key instigator in that earlier Wolf Congress that I talked about, the one that they were planning for, but it fell through. And so when the Communist Party became involved, Duchesne was recruited for the process. She'd probably worked closely with Cataneo in the past, as they were both working with working class women in the Paris region. And she became president of the organization. And so she acted as a sort of figurehead, a figure that women in Paris knew, and women in France and more broadly knew and would be more likely to join because of. But she sort of didn't do the bulk of the work day to day. And then finally, we talk about the British leader of the CMF, Charlotte Haldane. She wasn't the British leader from the beginning, but she was also impacted by the Dreyfus affair. So there's a real common theme running through there, because she was a woman of Jewish heritage. Her father was a German Jew. She was very politically motivated throughout her youth, but she wasn't involved with the Communist Party until the 1920s, when she met her husband, who was a biologist, a really important biologist called J.B.S. Haldane. They were both covert communists by the 1930s, although they hadn't joined the Communist Party by the time she had joined with the CMF. She became the editor of Woman Today, and eventually she became the leader of the British section, and then the revamped CMF in 1939, when it moved its headquarters from Paris to London in the wake of several scandals involving the Soviet Union.
So as you describe them, and also in the book you do this as well, having these different backgrounds really extends the reach of the CMF in a lot of interesting ways. Like you say, there's different classes, there's different party affiliations, there's different reputations. And I think that's part of the reason the CMF probably is able to reach into so many different audiences and geographically as well. So let's talk a little bit more about that and how that manifests in the congresses that they host. So as you write about in chapter two, they have two major congresses that really bring members together. And they had another one planned for Cuba, right, in 1939, yes. Which is really interesting. Unfortunately, did not happen because of the war. But tell me more about what their intentions were with these events. What did the idea of a Congress offer as an organizing strategy? And then we can talk a little bit more about, you know, who actually went to those.
Absolutely. So the congresses offered a chance for these women to meet, to discuss CMF business in person. Most of the time it was done through correspondence and letter writing. Occasionally a CMF activist from France, for example, would visit Belgium to help their section develop. But by and large, everything was done through correspondence. So this gave them an opportunity to discuss things in person, to discuss the way that the international group was pivoting, things that smaller national sections could do to grow, to discuss things like their journals. It was also a really useful tool for attracting new members to these congresses, especially the 1934 one, really attracted a wide variety of women and gave this image of a really international, diverse group, which was exactly what they were trying to foster. It also allowed them to demonstrate support for a number of causes, women's rights, anti-fascism, also for the Soviet Union, which was shown quite a lot in Congress decorations and things like that, and to establish their understanding of fascism at that time. It does change throughout their really short lifespan. From being something that might happen, maybe we should confront it, to it becoming more concrete, to eventually this is a real threat now to other countries. It's quite firmly entrenched in places like Germany and Italy and Japan, but it's a real concern for the spread. And it also, as I say, it allowed them to demonstrate its internationalism, which was a key part of these congresses. So national dress, different languages were encouraged. There were constant displays of fraternity and support, and the idea of sisterhood was really pushed at these congresses as a way to link women from diverse backgrounds together.
Can you break down a little bit more what those backgrounds were? Like, who is attending these conferences, and what does it tell you about the reach and the spread of the CMF?
Absolutely. So the two major international congresses in 1934 and 1938 were held in France. The 1938 Congress was meant to be held, I believe, in Czechoslovakia, but obviously by that point, international events had made that a little bit more difficult to arrange and to ensure the safety of the attendees. So they decided to hold it in Marseille instead. So the national composition of these congresses, which we only know for certain in the 1934 case, were likely incredibly French. The 1934 Congress was incredibly French. But there were representatives from all across Europe, Western Europe, Scandinavia, Central Europe, occasionally from Eastern Europe too, primarily the Soviet Union, but occasionally other places too. There were delegates and representatives from the Americas. The United States sent people. So did places like Uruguay, for example. A couple of South American women did attend or supported the Congress. There were women who attended from Asia as well. Chinese women were often highlighted as attending as very important, especially with the outbreak of the Second Sino-Japanese War with the invasion of Manchuria, before the CMF was created, and also from a far afield as Australia, although obviously the number of these delegates were incredibly small because of the monetary commitment that was involved with traveling to France. There was also a real diversity in terms of social background of attendees. There were women from a variety of working backgrounds. So there were some, I think they described it as worker delegates. They were the highest attended group for both French and non-French delegates. So they made up the most proportion. There were peasants, rural workers, I think is what it means here. Women from the civil service, women who were in liberal careers, women who weren't employed at all. There were a real wide variety of women who attended, and it wasn't just women from bourgeois backgrounds. Most of the women who had traveled from further afield, from other continents, were bourgeois women who had their own kind of funding. But there were women from the working classes who attended, who were mainly French in these cases.
And what about the political character of these congresses? You talk about the CMF as sort of an early Popular Front organization. What's the political association of attendees, and also what's the character of the Congress itself?
So numerically, the communists definitely dominated delegates, both French and non-French, which was how they were reported in Congress reports. But there were a significant number of pacifists involved, who would largely have probably been bourgeois women. There was also a significant number of socialists, and this did increase with later congresses as well. But it was very clear that communist influence permeated proceedings, and it was something that Wolf representatives who attended really highlighted in their reports to the executive committee. There were red flags flown everywhere. The workers' salute, the raised fist, was given constantly as a response to speeches and things like that. The International was sang for the arrival of delegates, again, as a response to speeches, again, just about at any time that they felt any sort of solidarity. There was also a key Congress slogan for 1934, which was to support the peace policy of the USSR, country of the emancipated woman. So they were meant to be a covert organization, but in reality, communist influence really did dominate the proceedings of CMF Congresses.
Let's talk a little bit more about that. And that's sort of what your next chapter is about, the CMF as a communist front organization, but also one that has a considerable amount of freedom and flexibility. So you look at two aspects of the sort of relationship between CMF leadership and the Soviet Union, one of which is correspondence, and the other is political tourism, which I think is really interesting as well. So let's start with the letters between CMF leadership. How does that reveal their relationship essentially with the Communist Party?
Absolutely. So many of the responses from the Soviet side of things aren't recorded. However, from the correspondence from the French CMF leadership, who were the main people who were talking to Soviet women, it was quite relaxed. It wasn't responding to directives and things like that. Everything was framed as requests for advice. How would you go about doing this? Can we have material on women in the Soviet Union for use in our publications to distribute to other national sections? But it was also really friendly correspondence. It was clear that the leaders of the CMF and the representatives of Soviet women in the Comintern were really quite close and had spent considerable time together over the years. And the key women here on the Soviet side of things are Elena Stasova and Maria Krylova, who were both really deeply involved with Comintern work. There were stories of, or there were discussions about how Soviet women had tret the children of CMF leadership who had been sent to Moscow to kind of develop their communist education. It's a really interesting way of discussing CMF business. It's always really, really friendly and advice-based, which was not what I was expecting when I came across this correspondence. I was expecting it to be more kind of direct orders from the Comintern on what to do. But it appears that the CMF really did have a lot of freedom when talking with the Soviet representatives and in their work.
And that sort of affective side of these relationships also plays out in sort of the idea of political tourism. Can you talk more about how that functioned? What are the logistics of it? And what did the CMF get out of this type of tourism to the Soviet Union?
Absolutely. So these visits tended to be primarily propagandistic for both sides, for the CMF and for the Comintern. So for the CMF, these visits were very useful for demonstrating their international connections, for showing to both its membership and those who might be interested in joining the CMF that they were really closely connected to important people. And also it was a really useful propaganda exercise in terms of conversion. It may not entirely convert somebody from a socialist or a non-party woman to a communist woman, but it often put really positive images of the Soviet Union in these women's heads, and they were more likely to be sympathetic towards the Soviet Union. From the Soviet side of things, from the Comintern side of things, that was also a key outcome of these trips, was propaganda conversion, the opportunity to get involved with women who may have been socialist and have inroads with the Socialist Party, and use them after these trips as, I suppose, spies may not be the correct word, but as women who could report back on socialist feeling and business. They really identified women who were primed for conversion. The Soviet guides kept reports on each woman and their susceptibility to Soviet propaganda. So for both sides, they were really useful for propaganda praising the Soviet Union and increasing susceptibility to communism. These trips generally kind of logistically were huge. It wasn't as though they just kind of stayed in Moscow and saw the model institutions in Moscow. They traveled across a few Soviet countries. For example, Azerbaijan was a huge one. They spent a lot of time in Baku, the Caucasus region, the Georgia, Ukraine sometimes. They went across the Western Soviet Union and did a lot of different things. They went to parks, sanatoriums, education centers, factories, refineries. They went to just about everywhere they could. Obviously, they were all model institutions. It wasn't as though they saw the real Soviet Union, but that was part of the propaganda side of these visits.
So let's continue talking about the international links, because the next section of your book looks at sort of four of the main international campaigns that the CMF ran. So that's the Spanish Civil War, the rise of Nazism in Germany, the Second Sino-Japanese War, and the Italian invasion of Ethiopia. So lots of global reach. But as you write, each one of those campaigns has a very different character. So let's just go through them one by one, starting with Spain. What were the CMF's sort of main lines of effort in their campaign around the Spanish Civil War? And then to link back to this theme that you weave throughout the book in terms of how they actually portray femininity, how are they imagining women's roles in that war?
So this, I think, is my personal favorite part of the book. These campaigns were all on different topics and were approached in very different ways. So in Spain, the main line of campaigning was through consciousness raising, through the promotion of news from Spain, and specifically news about the impact of the war on Spanish women and children, and focusing specifically on the fascist atrocities towards Spanish and women and children. They didn't necessarily talk about the atrocities occurring from the other side. It was very anti-fascist. And they also did a lot of fundraising. They were consistently organizing food drives, material and moral aid drives, and specifically fundraising as well. And that was an effort that continued from the outbreak of the Spanish Civil War in 1936 up until the outbreak of the Second World War, even beyond kind of the traditionally held end of the Spanish Civil War. The portrayal of women in each of these international campaigns, I think, is probably one of the most interesting, because despite being a communist front organization that often advocated for women's emancipation in various areas, when it came to discussing their international campaigns, especially in their presses, they often reverted to focusing on women's role as mother and how that was so important and it must be protected, and how women as mothers are mujeres, as in the case of the Spanish Civil War. They were passive victims of war. They were impacted by war the most. They not only saw their husbands and sons and brothers killed, but they also had to deal with kind of the emotional weight of war as well. But on the flip side, in the Spanish Civil War case, they also put a heavy focus on milicianas, so women who were this more masculinized image of a woman fighter who were directly at the front lines fighting alongside men. And it was actually framed when women were recalled from the front lines, when they were banned from fighting in the Spanish Civil War, that it was the impact of viewing women dying on the front line. That's how the CMF framed it. It was the impact of seeing women dying on the front line on men that necessitated them being called back. Although this was not really the reason, it was sort of the concern of having a inverted commas stronger front line, especially for the communist side of things.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, that ambiguity about women and conflict is something that comes up over and over again.
Yes.
And especially in your work as well. Let's move on to sort of the other big fascist threat in Europe, which is Nazism in Germany. What does the CMF campaign around that look like?
So comparatively, I think because in terms of shocking events that kind of are reported on regularly, the consensus about what was happening in Nazi Germany seemed to be a lot more gradual. And as a result, it wasn't seen as being this immediate threat until it was, if that makes sense. And so initially it was kind of a very slow burn of a campaign. It wasn't fundraising, for example. It wasn't the raising of material aid or food aid or clothing. It was more about dealing with the impact of fascism in Germany on specific women. So there were a lot of cases of women imprisoned in Nazi Germany for political activism that wasn't sanctioned by the Nazi authorities. So, for example, a lot of communist women were arrested. And one of their biggest campaigns was on Lisa Lotherman, who was a communist woman who was imprisoned for working covertly as a communist. And she was sentenced to death. And it was this idea of writing to important Nazi officials, but also to the wives of Nazi officials, begging kind of for her life and saying you can't execute her because she's a mother, she's a woman. And she was the first woman who had been sentenced to death for this. And eventually she was executed. So the success of this campaign was negligible. However, it did get the rank and file of the CMF involved with directly engaging with Nazi authorities, which is something unique among their campaigns. But as you kind of move along in the CMF's lifetime, it becomes more of a concern about the spread of Nazism or fascism across Europe, and the concern about the implementation of, and this is a quote, reactionary and degrading ideas on the family, education, people and race in German women, and the idea that this might spread across Europe, and all the gains that women had made since the end of the First World War might be completely destroyed as a result.
Hmm. Well, let's talk more about what that campaign looks like when it's happening outside of Europe. I thought one of the really interesting chapters in your book is about sort of what anti-fascism looks like in a non-European context, mm-hmm. specifically Ethiopia and China. What does the CMF campaign in Ethiopia say about the organization's approach to race? And is there a different character to the type of work that they're doing?
Yeah, so these two campaigns, this chapter on kind of the more global, less European campaigns, were the two that I really focused on post-PhD, because I wanted to kind of look more at how race was a factor in CMF campaigns. From the very beginning, the idea of self-determination and decolonization were involved in CMF congresses, in their manifestos, in their work plans. But it actually turned out to be quite contradictory. The CMF's approach to these international events happening outside of Europe could be quite contradictory. So there was a real focus on self-determination for the Ethiopian people, the idea of Ethiopian civilization, Ethiopia being one of the more civilized, in inverted commas, nations in Africa at this time. That was a major idea among kind of international politicians and politics. So there was a real focus on Ethiopian civilization as a reason that it should be left alone and not invaded by Italy. But there was also, there was real infantilizing language utilized across CMF campaigns. I don't think it was necessarily that they intended to infantilize Ethiopian populations. I think it was probably the case that these outdated understandings of what it meant to be Ethiopian, African, or Africanness in general was intended to appeal to white Europeans and their general understanding of Africa to support fundraising efforts. And one of the most interesting parts of the language deployed, I think, in the Ethiopian campaign was that war trauma and the idea of how war has impacted generations of women was deployed, but it was deployed regarding Italian women's experiences rather than Ethiopian women's experiences. So it was about how the earlier war with Ethiopia that Italy had when it had tried to invade in the late 19th century, how the impact of that, the death of people around women at that time, was passed down from that generation to the generation who had went through the First World War, to the generation who were going through this second invasion of Ethiopia. And it was really interesting to me that it was kind of more of the focus, more of the trauma of Italian women who were sort of geographically removed from the fighting in Ethiopia versus the women who were there experiencing the conflict firsthand, which I thought was really interesting and kind of contradictory to how they had framed themselves in their congresses and in their official documents.
Absolutely. And what about in the Asian context, in the Sino-Japanese War? I'm also really interested in this idea of the Warfin, the War Orphan campaign. That seems like a really unique instance. So could you talk more about what the CMF was doing in China and specifically how that campaign functioned?
I think the Second Sino-Japanese War campaign was probably up there with the Spanish Civil War campaign as the CMF's most kind of fleshed out, most complete. And one of the ones that the CMF focused on the most in its activism. So they sent CMF activists over there. Charlotte Holden, who I spoke about earlier, was one such woman who spent a long time in China reporting for the CMF and for others, for the British government as well, about what was happening in China, the situation on the ground, what was happening for children in particular. There were a vast number of issues in China at this period that meant that there was a huge orphaned population. So it wasn't just the war, there was the flooding, there was flooding across China, some as a result of kind of war sabotage and some just as natural events, that essentially meant that there was a large population of children who didn't have parents or guardians anymore, or children who still had fathers, but the fathers had gone off to war. So there was a real diverse group of children who had been left orphaned. And as a result, there was a need to house these children and to look after them. And so the CMF, as a result of Charlotte Holden's witnessing these children's homes and how they operated, set up a fundraising campaign which really reflected the move towards child sponsorship as an effective humanitarian campaign in the interwar period. You see the growth of groups like Save the Children, Plan International, those types of groups, and the CMF followed this same line for children in China. They asked people to send in small amounts of money and they would be allocated a child who would be their adopted child. And it was a really, really interesting campaign that probably was the most individual successful campaign in this period. It raised a vast amount of money for the Chinese war relief effort. And it, I think it had even, within about a month or two, had already over fundraised, had already beaten the fundraising for the CMF Spanish campaign. So it was really, really successful. And it was designed to kind of ensure that these children were well looked after in these children's homes, which was a major Chinese based campaign as well. It was something that the Chinese were really focused on, but the CMF kind of transported that and the focus on children to women in Europe specifically, in Britain and France in particular. So it was a really interesting campaign that was very different from anything else they did, in that it focused entirely on children and women weren't really involved in that in terms of being the recipients of aid. Mm-hmm.
Well, we've talked a lot about the international reach of the CMF. Let's briefly talk about the national issues, because as you mentioned at the beginning, the bulk of their membership is actually British and French. So what are the issues that they are focused on within those two countries? Are there local political problems that they see as being part of their purview?
Absolutely. So to take France, because France was experiencing something different from other European countries in this period, in that it hadn't given women the right to vote and wouldn't for another 10 or so years at the foundation of the CMF. So the French section were really focused on gaining the right to vote for women. They were consistently organising protests. They were publishing pamphlets. They were writing in CMF journals about the different attempts by the French Senate and Assembly to introduce different legislation that would technically enfranchise women, but not really, and how this couldn't be allowed to happen, and to keep advocating for the right to vote. But outside of France, it doesn't seem that the other CMF sections really kind of highlighted this difference between French women and those elsewhere in Europe who had the right to vote. It was very much something that the French section focused on and others kind of ignored was happening. But something that both the French and British section, who are kind of the two that I focus on primarily, something that they do both have issues with is attacks on women's right to work. And this kind of comes from broader concerns about the spread of fascism and how fascism attacks women's rights to work. Both the French and British sections identified trends happening within their own governments towards restrictions on women's right to work or women's rights to be economically independent. And so, again, there were several protests and things like that that the French section were involved in. They were constantly working alongside Amsterdam Pleyel in demonstrations to tackle this kind of these attacks on women's right to work. And similarly in England, that was also the case. They both promoted strike movements. The French CMF had an entire special edition based on these huge strikes that happened in 1936 in France, where a huge proportion of the working population went on strike. It was something that they used to promote communist trade unions and memberships of those. But also you can see the Popular Front creeping in here too, because it becomes not just the CGTU, but also the socialist trade unions are being promoted. So that's very important. And then, of course, there are reproductive rights, things like abortion and things like that, that I talk about a bit more in the next chapter too. Mm-hmm.
So interestingly, they're aligning with a lot of other local feminist concerns, but bringing this sort of anti-fascist analysis to it, that seems different.
Yes.
Let's talk about, you've spoken about this in answering these other questions, but let's talk specifically about how the CMF engages these different models of womanhood. Mm-hmm. And you do that through looking at their publications and journals. So could you talk a little bit more about sort of the politics of motherhood, the politics of makeup, the politics of women's health? Like, what did their publications look like? And how do you draw out these themes about femininity from them?
So that's another part of the CMF that is incredibly complex and contradictory. The journals, while technically being political literature, actually tend to lean towards kind of the traditional, the maternalist, the stereotypical idea of what women would be interested in. And a lot of that is to do with the fact that disposable income for their target audience, so working class women, wouldn't be that great and likely wouldn't stretch to kind of two separate journals or newspapers. So it would be unlikely that they would spend the money on a political magazine when they also want to read like lifestyle magazines. So the CMF try to incorporate both into one. And this is something that comes up when talking about makeup, cosmetics, skincare specifically, because in one case, in the British journal Woman Today, a socialist communist activist called Joan Beauchamp writes about how women who are serious political activists shouldn't be wasting their time wearing makeup. It doesn't matter. It doesn't make a difference to their political activism, shouldn't be doing it. And very interestingly, and for probably one of the only times in the Woman Today history, the next month they have a sort of letters to the editor page about this specific article. And it was very, very controversial, it seems. There were people who supported her and said, absolutely, women as political activists shouldn't care about this. But then there were some who said, well, no, actually, political activism might be more effective if women are looking pleasant, don't look like they've just been in the factory all day and are half dead. Maybe it'll be more effective if they're talking to other people and look pleasant and put together and well cared for. It's odd because in terms of how cosmetics and things like that are portrayed, there is very little in terms of specific politics that come into it, although there is, again, in Woman Today, there is a discussion about how wearing makeup is anti-fascist, because the emancipatory Soviet Union encourages it and really says that you should use it because it's an example of science, and the development of our understanding of cosmetics is because of scientific discovery. And women in Nazi Germany are not encouraged to wear it because it's fascist. They're traditionalists. They don't care about scientific exploration and technological development. So this is really the only time that it's mentioned. And it's such an odd thing because I would think in a journal that has a specific page for women's health and beauty, as both Woman Today and Femme dans l'Action Mondiale, the French journal, have. They both have specific pages dedicated to these topics, that it doesn't come up more often, that there isn't more of a focus on how makeup is politics. I think that our lipstick is politics is the name of the article that I'm talking about. So it's interesting how that isn't developed more. But generally, it's very traditional. Traditionally feminine pastimes are presented in a very traditional way. Motherhood is elevated above everything else as the most important thing. Women's healthcare often comes second to childcare, child healthcare in the pages on healthcare in these journals. So it's really interesting how much maternalism and maternalist language comes into CMF journals, which are ostensibly meant to be political documents, they actually become much more of a lifestyle document by a certain point, especially in the British case.
It sounds like a great reflection of that sort of messiness and complexity that you were talking about earlier. So tell us what happens to the CMF. They're planning this Congress in Cuba. It's 1939. We all know what happens then. You know, where do they go from here? How do they end? What happens to their leadership?
Absolutely. So something I didn't touch upon earlier on really was that 1939 Congress in Cuba, which was meant to be even more of a demonstration of the internationalness of the group, the idea that it wasn't just European-centered, although in practice it very much was. It's this kind of this image-building exercise that it does. But because of the outbreak of war in 1939, it becomes very clear that they can't hold a Congress in Cuba. It would be now impossible to get from Europe to America in enough of... In as many numbers as it would need to be to make any kind of an impact and make it worthwhile. Earlier in 1939, the CMF became the World Committee for Peace and Democracy because it sort of wanted to get away from the image of the Soviet Union that had become more of the case since the 1930s, specifically the purges. But also this was very useful for the CMF or the World Committee for Peace and Democracy after the Nazi-Soviet Pact too. It was an attempt to kind of get away from the obvious communist links, although they were still there. But the Nazi-Soviet Pact, I think, really did have the biggest impact on the CMF as a group. The General Secretary, Cataneo, the woman who really led this organization, quit communist politics altogether. She couldn't understand how communism and Nazism could work together at all when they're sort of diametrically opposed in many ways. And she had spent the past 5 years working in an anti-fascist capacity, how she was supposed to just accept that fascism was the new ally. It didn't make sense to her. And she thought it was very hypocritical of the Soviets. And so she essentially quit communist politics as a result. Didn't have anything to do with politics during or after the Second World War, although she did work with organizations during the Vichy regime to help Jewish children to ensure their safety. So she was involved in sort of the humanitarian side of things for a little bit, but after the war, she just completely lived out her days quite happily with her family, didn't get involved with communist politics. But on the other hand, Maria Rabaté, she became heavily involved in communist politics. She already was a member of the Communist Party, but she used those communist links to become involved in the resistance. Octave, her husband, was sent to a concentration camp, and that kind of galvanized her even further. She left her children with her parents and became heavily involved with the resistance. And eventually, after the war, she became a deputy to the National Assembly as a communist. She sat for the Seine region. She sat on committees for the family, education, population, public health, reconstruction and war damage. So she was really heavily involved, and she sat in her seat in the Seine for a good 15 or 20 years. For Duchenne, she, as a fellow traveller, actively remained in support of the Soviet Union, which is quite odd when you think about it, because again, she should be really focused on the pacifist and anti-fascist side of things more so than the communist side of things. But she remained as a stalwart defender of the Soviet Union, I think, at least up to her death. I'm pretty sure she remained a stalwart supporter of the Soviet Union, at least until the years leading up to her death. She had to escape from Paris with the invasion of Germany because it was assumed that she would be wanted by the Gestapo as somebody who was heavily involved in anti-fascist activism. She survived the war, came back to Paris. She remained president of WILF until her death. And again, she was constantly involved with praising the Soviet Union their achievements, in inverted commas, throughout her life. And then for Haldane, she also broke from the Communist Party, but a little bit later than Cataneo. So she was still a communist into the Second World War. And eventually she travelled to the Soviet Union to report on what was happening on the Eastern Front and for the people of the Soviet Union. But she realized when she was there how uninformed the Soviet people were about what was happening on the Western Front. They didn't know anything about the Blitz, for example. She witnessed extreme poverty and the overworking of Soviet peasants for the war efforts. And she came back and said, I can't in good conscience support the Communist Party anymore, which resulted in her break from the British Communist Party, but also her she broke up with her husband as well. She split from her husband, divorced him because he still resolutely believed in the Soviet Union. And by 1949, she'd published an anti-Soviet memoir, which demonstrates kind of a lot of bitterness towards the Soviet Union not long afterwards. And again, kind of beyond that, was involved more heavily in publishing translations and things like that, wasn't so involved with the politics side of things anymore. So they all kind of went in very diverse directions. None of them ended up in the same place, except from probably Duchenne, who kept a firm grip on the French section of Wilf, something which was, I'm sure, the bane of many French pacifist activists' lives for a time.
So I think you make a really good case in this book that despite a very short lifespan, I mean, we're really only looking at about 5 years of activism, that the CMF is a pretty unique organization. I'm interested to hear you talk about sort of why you think this matters for scholarship. You know, why should we know more about the CMF? And especially in the particular historical moment we're in now with this rise of populist and even proto-fascist movements and politicians, what is it about the CMF that's important for audiences? What do you want your readers to get from this book?
For me, the CMF is an incredibly important and unique group because not only is it sort of a precursor of the Popular Front, which I would argue directly led or directly helped with the implementation of the Popular Front strategy by the Comintern, but it's also an example of a relatively successful women's communist front organization in a period where that was a rarity and before some of the most important women's groups of the 20th century, post-World War II groups like the Women's International Democratic Federation, which can and has by historians been directly linked with the CMF. It had a real kind of freedom, which a lot of communist front groups didn't get to have. So it had some support from communist parties, financial and moral, but also had the ability to kind of expand beyond traditional communist group remits. It was ambitious and wide-reaching in that it considered things rather globally, which was in many cases unusual for women's groups in this period beyond the sort of large international groups like the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. And it focused on specifically political topics like fascism and anti-fascism that those women's groups that I just mentioned didn't necessarily. And because of the freedom from the Comintern that it had, it was able to work closely with key women's organizations, which probably made it one of the very few communist front organizations that worked very closely with non-communist international organizations in this period. And because it has been, going back to one of the first questions, because it has been neglected because of this presumed lack of sources up until recently, I think that the possibilities for research into this group, its work on national and international scales, I think the possibilities for that are endless. I think there's so much you can do if you are interested in the French side of things, the British side of things, Belgian. I know of some historians currently working on the Yugoslav group, for example, which is something that I can't do because of language difficulties. But I do think that the opportunities for further research into this group are boundless. And I think that now is the perfect time for that research because of these growing populist movements, the attacks on women's liberty and freedoms and rights that have been enshrined for so long, like the recent repeal of Roe v. Wade and the criminalization of abortions in some US states. I think now is the perfect time to be talking about groups like this and how they organized, the successes that they had, the failures that they had, the successes that they had in terms of bringing women from a diverse from diverse backgrounds together are incredibly important for confronting the threat that women face in several areas at this point. And because the CMF worked on such a diverse set of topics, they're the perfect group to kind of look at and say what worked in this period and why, and what kind of strategies could we adopt or develop from this group that could be useful in the future in confronting these threats from populist and proto-fascist groups. So I think it's an organization that can teach us a lot in the present day with current political trends, for certain.
Well, that is a fantastic call to action, both for researchers and for activists, and I think a great way to wrap up this interview. I'll just ask you one more question, which is, what are you working on now? Are you taking this research further post-PhD?
So I am currently working on another article on the CMF about the relationship between the French National Section and women activists in places like Algeria. It was meant to be kind of a more broad look at the French colonies, but I think in terms of source availability, it will generally kind of focus on Algeria. So that's one aspect of research that I'm doing and might well be my last CMF focused piece of scholarship, at least for a while. It would be something that I would love to do, to look into the French section and its work on a more sort of micro scale than I did in this book. But that's something that I'm going to put away for a little bit, give myself a break. But I am kind of looking into doing some more about women and French communism. So that's a side of things that I'm looking into for my next project, I think.
Excellent. Well, I'll look forward to that. And like you say, there's lots of room for other researchers to pick up some slack here. So hope that we'll see more on the CMF in the coming years. Jasmine, again, thank you so much for coming on the show today. It's really been a pleasure.
Thank you. I've really enjoyed myself. Thank you for your questions.
Well, I'm Rebecca Turkington. You've been listening to New Books in Women's History, a channel of the New Books Network, and we've been discussing Jasmine Calver's new book, Antifascism, Gender, and International Communism, the Comité Mondial des Femmes contre la Guerre et le Fascisme, 1934 to 1941. And that is a brand new 2022 release from Routledge. Thank you so much.